This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Get on to the review of the show then, and I mean, I don't know what version of it you watched. I'm in the UK here, we don't have the network, and even if we did, I think I'd still probably watch the original feed, because I just, like, I'm very picky. I don't want my WF logo have being like, you know, freezed out. Do they do that still? Like,
No. They've made it in the United States, at least, where they don't ever have to blot out any WWF stuff, or even when they say the word WWF.
And Jesse's there as well, because that was
a bad full thing Jesse. For a while.
And
editing.
They don't do any shit like fast forward or anything. Maybe you'll get
Yes. Very small, slight edits on the network version that I watched, where you could tell that they cut out like kind of the interstitial stuff between the matches, where all the Mean Gene interview segments are there, but there may have been some scenes where they may have kind of cut out packages
did they cut out the pointless segments with Sean Mooney in the crowd, for example.
No, those are still there. In fact, you can actually see the moments on the digitized version, where you could tell that the tape library guys had trouble with it, because if you watch the beginning of the show, you can see the parts where the tape kind of like scratches a bit. And it's interesting, because what they had to have done by digitizing it is that they must have ran it through. But when they ran it through, they may have had trouble with the actual film. So you could see like parts of the show from the WWE archives where it kind of goes like that. You know, it gets all weird and cloudy. So it was kind of interesting. But no, Sean Mooney's there interviewing Honky Tonk Man and sitting in the crowd being amazed by everybody cheering with that stupid fucking look on his face. Yeah, that's all still there.
I only mentioned that because my version started with that awesome, old school SummerSlam music. And there was a package like showing fans turning up and stuff. Did you get that?
Yes. They're all eating ice cream and riding wagons. And actually, that's the Royal Rumble music. They didn't. The first time they didn't. The SummerSlam music that I think people are most familiar with is that one that has like that kind of like really strong like pipe chord. And that didn't start until 1990, I would have to guess, because 1989 is the Royal Rumble music. But what they did is they took the last part of the musical theme and they kind of like and they remixed it just a little bit to make it seem slightly different. But no, it's basically the Royal Rumble music.
Yeah, and they basically play a package of various different wrestlers hitting their finishers against jobbers.
Yep,
and then,
that's
like, spliced with kids eating ice cream and melons and various other things. That's extra bizarre. Our hosts are, very weirdly, Tony Schiavone on this show, of course. He was they signed him from WCW. And for whatever reason, they thought they'd give him a tryout on the pay-per-view here with of course, for my money, the best color man ever, by some distance, Jesse Ventura. Thoughts on Tony Schiavone in the WF, guys?
I like him. I think he's pretty good. Like, he's a different voice and he's a solid voice. And, I don't think he's as good as, I don't like him as much as Monsoon or Vince. But I think he's good. He's solid.
I love Tony Schiavone. And even in WCW, even in the NWA with Bob Caudle and Jim Ross before he left to the WWF at that time, I loved him then. I loved him when he went to WCW. Even in the Nitro years when people shat on him because they didn't think he was as good as JR, I thought he did just fine. I think he's one of the most underrated lead announcers probably in the history of wrestling. I thought he must have been more of like a hot young name that kind of like JJ, because also at the same time I think JJ Dillon got poached by Vince to run television for him from the NWA, and I guess JJ, who was running TV, was a fan of Tony and brought Tony over. I don't know if that's the exact connection, but I can imagine that they had that familiarity help get Tony over there. But Tony, to me, was just fine. I didn't think he did a bad job at all. But you could see that he was a little overtly excited. It was kind of like when Michael Cole first got the job, and he was so like loud and rambunctious about everything. I'm sorry. I get the same feeling with Tony when I watch him in the SummerSlam main event, where he's like, he's about to explode. It's almost strange because Tony was more reserved as he got older, but I thought he did fine. I thought this was actually one of his better moments.
Did you just say Shivani was more reserved as he got older?
Yes. just a little bit.
This is the guy who gets the best Nitro in the history of wrestling every single week.
Oh,
but every week was better than the last, no?
In terms of the stupid crap that Eric Bischoff would tell him to say, yeah, but I'm talking about the delivery, like the method. You know, we'll get to the main event, but I'll explain what it is. But by the time we get to the finish of the main event, I mean, Tony Schiavone sounds like he's about to freaking pass out. The pitch in his voice is so high, I almost didn't think it was him.
Now, here's something that's interested me for some time, which is at some point around this time, it seems that Vince lost faith in Gorilla Monsoon to be the lead announcer on the pay-per-views. Because even after Schiavone goes, Vince himself takes over on a lot of the pay-per-views from here on out, and then he tries to get Jim Ross in. Any insight on, like, you know, why would Vince want to not use Gorilla around this time? Anyone?
No, I have no idea.
I would say this. I think, like, Vince historically, like, tends to, like, worry, I think, maybe a bit too much about someone either sounding too old or being too in the past if the product is changing. Because he does the same thing to JR. He kind of does the same thing to even moving himself out, like, he always kind of moves forward with these things, sometimes too early.
Well, I know in some quarters of the internet, and pro wrestling only, for example, there's a lot of guys who actually don't like Gorilla Monsoon. They think that he's wasn't a very good enough, like, he basically had a habit of burying guys on commentary and, like, by criticizing things during the match and stuff. How would you guys respond to those criticisms of Monsoon?
Monsoon would take his liberties. A good bit of time when he would call matches, that was kind of normal for him. He did that especially in the early 90s when he just stopped giving a shit and he would just ran on while he was taping that stuff in the studio with Johnny Polo or fucking Stan Lane or whoever it was. But in terms of, like, his overall announcing performances, I didn't really feel that. I didn't feel like he buried people. I think he was just selling the story.
Yeah, and that's something that him and Schiavone and even Vince did really well with, selling the story of the match. Mm-hmm. Like, Ventura would help with the color, but, like, they would talk about the moves. They would talk about, like, why they were doing certain things. It was just clearer, and it presented it. And I always liked it when the commentators presented it more like a sport. Quote unquote, right?
Yeah, I also thought Jesse and Tony had good chemistry here. I didn't feel like it was like an oil and water type of situation like Michael Cole and Jerry Lawler, where it's just like it's obviously they're just not the same. They're not the same type of personalities, and they don't mesh well. I thought Jesse and Tony did well. Jesse was good at being a heel announcer, and he really drives it home on this show. You know, he doesn't play favorites. He's awesome in this.
The only thing with Jesse and Schiavone, like, from the moment I see them, like, the way Jesse's dressed, you remember, like, he's wearing that, like, leopard thing with the mustache and the bandana, and Schiavone's in a tux. Like, all I could imagine was, like, like, Jesse's going to rape this guy by the end of the night. Like, this is going to be a horrible night for Tony Schiavone.
There's one moment of kind of hilarity in the Warrior Room match where he goes, "You're dumber than Monsoon is." Yeah.
That whole sequence is amazing.
This is basically a teaser trailer for the relationship that would then develop in WCW in 93. Where Schiavone and Ventura would be reunited. And basically, I think, like, they have a very interesting relationship, because Ventura bullies the shit out of Tony, right? It's like with Monsoon, there's a kind of like parity there because Monsoon was a wrestler as well, and like no matter what Jesse says, he kind of shows him a bit more respect. With Vince, obviously, you know, he will, he does take many liberties with Vince, as we've discussed, but with Vince kind of gives back as well, you know, he kind of fights back a bit. Shivani kind of like stonewalls. He's like, Ventura's just laying it in, like, you know, really laying it on thick, and Shivani just moves on to the next thing, or like doesn't have a comeback. And sometimes it comes across like Tony's taking it personally, like he takes it to heart, like you know, when he accuses him of different things. I kind of like that aspect of their relationship, where it's like, you know, Shivani's just like an all right kind of nice company guy, and Ventura's just a dick, you know, he's just,
And because Bobby and Tony did a lot of stuff together on Nitro, and Bobby's more of a shtick type of gimmick color commentator, which works great. He's had the greatest lines probably ever when it comes to being a color commentator. But Jesse kind of he hits that kind of like that surreal level where he starts saying things that really dig deep, and he's trying to get a good emotion out of you. And
there are moments on like quieter moments during like you know, smaller WCW, like, you know, it'll be like an Eric Watts match or something, and like Jesse's like accusing like Tony of, you know, maybe not being faithful to his wife, or like he really starts getting into like really weird areas with him. And you can tell that Shivani doesn't deal with these things well. So
carry on. I was just gonna say, with Ventura, I never once believed that he wasn't angry with his partner. Like, whoever it was, he was just always, they always had an argument before the pay-per-view went on the air, and there was always a discussion after, like, Jesse, you can't treat me like this. I can't.
Indeed, during this opening spiel, Jesse starts, as he means to go on, he's like, don't you get wild with me, Shivani. You're the man responsible for putting Bobby Heenan off the air. So he basically flames him for the Bobby Heenan show. And he's like, look, I'm going to not take any shit from you at all during this show. You're a dick. I'm the boss here. It's really funny. Like, anyway, so the first match then. You know, we're only a couple of hours in here. We're getting to our first match. It's the Hart Foundation versus the Brain Busters. Well, Andrew, what did you make of this one?
Oh, it's tag team wrestling at its finest. It goes about 15 minutes, which is what most of those top tier tag team matches usually went for when it came to these WWF shows. And I mean, Arn and Tully is my favorite tag team ever. You know, that even when it comes to Arn and Ole, people prefer them over Arn and Tully when it came to the Horsemen. And I feel like Tully and Arn had the best chemistry. I wish their run in the WWF lasted a little bit longer. They were great champions. Bobby gets into it a little bit. Bret Hart was starting to kind of come along more as an individual. And this match is just terrific. Great transitions, very smooth. It never bores you. What a great match.
Aaron?
I can't really add to that. Like, I will just say I agree. Commentators did, and showing us why a non-title match would happen, basically, and how important it still is, which in like the era of like non-title matches today, like, just doesn't happen. I loved it. I love that setup, and both these teams were great, and it's amazing that like that match could have that much importance.
Yeah.
Now, interestingly, Meltzer only gives this 2 stars, and he says,
he's a fucking idiot.
he says, as an opener, this was fine, but considering the talents of the four, quite disappointing, since they aren't opening match wrestlers. Started with slow, with no intensity or continual action, very slow-paced. All four didn't seem to show the spark that three of the four are quite clearly capable of. He basically
let me say this. Arn and Tully, they were the tag team champions also in the NWA. I think they were even the champions before they even signed with the WWF. I think they were still the champs in the NWA. And they were used to working these really long matches for about 20, maybe 25 minutes with guys like Wyndham and Lex Luger and the Road Warriors and the Russians and the Rock and Roll Express and they would just do everything and they would do the face in peril for both guys, and they would go through everything. And I think what Meltzer is trying to say is that he didn't like the fact that they were shrinking down the format for Arn and Tully when they were in the WWF, because it was less of what they were. It didn't show as much of the work as they did in the NWA. But the truth is, they were so good at digesting all the good stuff and fitting it into their matches that I thought it almost made their matches better when they went to the WWF.
Yeah, and just because a match is different doesn't mean it's less good.
Thank you.
It's just I'd almost rather how long was the match? Like, it was between 15
16
and 20,
to 15
right?
minutes.
Yeah, like I'd rather a great 15-minute match than a slightly worse 25-minute match.
I have to be honest, guys. This is not a heel turn, by the way. When I was a kid, when I first watched this match when I was a kid, I was like, this is the best match I've ever seen. there weren't that many great matches, especially on the pay-per-views around this time, and this one just seemed to have everything. And I was like, oh, this is awesome. So in my mind, I'd built up this match as being really quite great. And I have to be honest, when I watched it earlier, I was a little bit disappointed. I don't think it's a great match. And there's a lot of weird things in it. For example, 16 minutes long. For the first 10 of those minutes, the Hart Foundation are basically working a very long shine sequence. So you get Arn and Tully working heel in peril. Now, I've never really understood the psychology of why you'd work heel in peril. Like, so you've literally got the situation where Arn is going for a hot tag and getting cut off. So can you guys explain, like why would you have the faces cutting off the heels from making the tag? It seems arse backwards to me.
See, I actually really like that. Like, you're talking about the spot where, like, he's holding onto his hand and he just can't reach, and then he tags the foot, right? I agree with you to an extent that it's – that, like, I can't explain why you would do it. I know why I like it, because it's different. Like, I like that it's a different style of match, and I think the Hart Foundation's offense was interesting enough to carry it, as well as the selling of Arn and Tully, which is, like, bordering on comical.
Yeah, and the thing is that they tell the story that Brett is probably the best technical wrestler among the four, and that Jim is the powerhouse among the four. So it tells the story that Arn and Tully don't have the individual advantage, so they have to work around it and work together more, and probably cheat around it by, you know, distracting the ref and then hitting him from behind or trying to coax him in so that the other guy can blitz him, and then they'll do the face and peril thing there. So Arn and Tully had to work together more in order to take the Foundation down, because they were not as good individually as those two were, even though that's not necessarily true.
No, but I also think it actually helps keep the Hart Foundation somewhat strong too, because it's a non-title match. They're going to lose anyway. Like, at least it does give them that shine in the match. Not that they're going to go after the title right away, but it does present them as a strong team.
Well, I mean, I watched quite a bit of a while back. I watched quite a bit of AWA, and in AWA they'd always make these quite long tags with the with the faces dominating basically. This seemed like a really kind of AWA structure to me in this match. I don't know why, but I seemed like in my mind, I just thought there was more action and more stuff going on in this match. And maybe it's a kind of expectation versus what I actually saw type thing.
It had a lot more brawling than I remembered. That's what I remember from it.
I did like the moment, the transition, where Tully kind of basically ran all the way around the ring and then Arn cheap-shotted to gain advantage. I also liked that the Hart Foundation, despite being faces, were still not above using cheap tactics themselves. Mm-hmm. There's that one moment where Brett does the cheap knee into, I think, his Arn's back. Jesse's going mad about it on commentary. I enjoyed that. I don't know if you guys do star ratings, but 2-star seems too low. But, like, if you had to put star ratings on it, where would you go with it?
For me, I'd put it at probably at a 4.
Yeah, I'd probably go between 3.5.
Average.
Yeah, between 3.5 and 4.
Okay. Well, I think I'm about 3 with it, which is much lower than I remember. Maybe I was in a bad mood when I watched it or something. I don't know. But
I think we should all add a star for Arn Anderson covering his head while he pins. So that he looks like Tully. Which is a brilliant little move.
Which is hilarious because Arn Anderson is still balding by this point and Tully has a full head of hair.
Okay, well, interesting then. I'd be interested for listeners of this show to go back and watch that match again to see if you're still high on it or if it's kind of – because it's kind of gone down a little bit in my own estimation from this rewatch, which is a slight shame because if you'd asked me maybe 7-8 years ago to name my top 5 WF matches from this era, that one would have been there. And I don't even think it's in the top 3 matches of this show now, which is quite a big drop. We get a promo from Dusty now, who's wearing a police hat, and he's in the polka dots. Any thoughts on this promo?
The term "hot mess" comes to mind.
Yeah, literally, because he was doing segments where he was plumbing shit out of a toilet.
Do you know when you can tell Oakland wants to laugh? I thought this was one of those things. Like, if you look at Mean Gene's face, he's like trying to stop himself from laughing during this absurd Dusty promo. Also on the countdown, Dusty was given a little promo and he kept on calling himself Americana. do you know anything about that? Like, he was Americana Dusty Rhodes. So that was there, and he was wearing tie dye, not the polka dots, in that little insert promo during the countdown. So anyway, his opponent tonight is the Honky Tonk Man. Just one little note going into this match. At one point, did you notice the camera does a close-up right on Dusty's big old ass there? And it's like, why is the camera zooming in? And it's like, are you going to stop this shot where we're just kind of looking? Because it really fills the screen. And it, especially in widescreen now, it was quite like... it gave me a little moment where I was like, what am I doing with my life? Looking at Dusty's arse here. And like, the commentators went really quiet as well. It was really kind of a, you know, profound little moment. Anyway, Aaron, what do you make of this one?
The match? Yeah, it's inoffensive. It's fine. The crowd is into it. Dusty is great at working the crowd. And the promo that Honky cuts as he leaves with Sean Mooney is fantastic. Where he's clearly like concussed, like a level 10 concussion. I love in the promo too that like he goes out of his way to say that the Honky Tonk Man can't sing. I don't know if you remember that about the promo. You can't sing.
Yeah.
Like,
mm-hmm. He does.
But he's wearing the hat and the nightie. He's like a village person, like saying this about the Honky Tonk Man.
Andrew, any thoughts?
No, it was okay. You know, it was just there. You know, and it was obvious that the people knew who Dusty was at least a little bit from his previous era, and he feeds off the crowd pretty well, doing the elbow and doing kind of drawing them in and stuff. And I think he did fine. And I think Honky was still at a point where physically he was still able to move around and do some stuff. And Jimmy's great. I thought it was just fine. I didn't think it was terrible, but it wasn't. It was average. It was just another match.
Dave Meltzer says -2 stars.
Oh, come on.
No, that's like Divas bad. Come on.
Candidate for worst match on a big show of the year.
Oh man.
And with WrestleMania 5, like, yeah. Isn't that the one that had like Jake and Andre the Giant?
He says he was at one point this match was on a -3 stars, but he's given it 1 star for the finish because he reckons the finish was good. I agree with Aaron that the highlight was clearly the Sean Mooney interview with Honky,
where he name drops Priscilla and Lisa Marie.
Yeah,
he thinks he's got amnesia and he thinks he's Elvis. You know, ridiculous.
And he has a show to do. He's trying to get to the stage.
It's just one of those, like, surreal moments, you know. Did that just happen? no, I think minus two stars is clearly far too harsh. Far too harsh on this match. He says that it's almost all stalling and rest holds. Is that true?
No. It ends with a guitar shot to the face.
It possibly was given a little bit too long, but no, I thought it was all right, you know.
And the guitar shot doesn't break the guitar either, like, so it's possible he is actually concussed in that interview.
Yeah, it's not like one of those like prop El Cabans that Jeff Jarrett. I mean, that was like that almost felt like a legit guitar hitting you right in the face. Doesn't even crack a bit.
And then like a 600-pound man jumped on him.
Okay. No, I think it was all right. So the next match then, we'll rattle in through these. Mr. Perfect making an appearance here, and he's taking on the Red Rooster. Now, during this match, just a couple of notes. Jesse Ventura claims that he invented the standing dropkick during this match. Now, I don't know if you ever watched any Jesse Ventura match. Like, have you ever seen any Ventura as a wrestler?
Yes.
Because
no.
He was not a good worker, and I cannot imagine him doing a standing drop kick. You know, so I don't know if that's I don't know if that's true. Yes. So, what did you make of this one, Andrew?
I'm trying to remember this one, and because it was a pretty forgettable match overall.
3 minutes, yeah.
Yeah, it was. I can't really say much about it. I don't remember much really at all. Sorry.
Any thoughts, Aaron?
I remember the ending just coming out of nowhere. Like they just like Mr. Perfect just basically picked him up through the ropes and Perfect plexed him. But like, how do you explain the Red Rooster to someone? Imagine you're trying to get someone into wrestling. Like, what is that? Like, what's with the, like, how do you explain the hair? Like, my wife was in the room when I was watching it earlier today, and like, I feel so embarrassed. Like, oh, he was a protege, and then he decided to just become a chicken, and that's who he is now. And he clucks his head when he walks, and yeah. he's in there with a legitimately serious wrestler. So
you know what, I lied. The one thing I do remember is that Curt Hennig and Terry Taylor were like the finalists for the role of Mr. Perfect, and they didn't know who they wanted to give it to, and Curt Hennig was the one who got it in the beginning of 1989 or maybe late 88. And I do remember thinking, like, we were so close to Terry Taylor being the guy on the left, and Curt Hennig being the guy with the big red mohawk clucking his head back and forth on the right, and instead it went the other way around. That was the one thing I remember. But after that, I realized, you know, Terry Taylor was a solid young wrestler. He was great at Mid-South and the UWF, but it was better off that Curt Hennig was the guy squashing Terry Taylor, not Terry Taylor squashing Curt Hennig.
Yes.
I have one note about this match, which is I thought Taylor worked it really unusually. Like, he was almost working heelish. Like, he threw Perfect out of the ring. Like, Ventura actually calls him on it. He's like, why is the Red Rooster taking this match outside? Like, he was, like, surprised that he was trying to make it more into, like, a brawl or whatever, which is seen as kind of rule-breakery behavior, you know, because the idea is that faces are clean cut, you know, they play by the rules. I thought that was a bit strange, because it was almost like Perfect came across as the... It's almost like the baby face do it, like, in the way they work the match. So there we go. I also thought that Perfect kind of buried him a bit on the promo later on. Where he's
he did. He did.
Oh, yeah.
That was his parting shot to Terry Taylor, like, you didn't get the role I did.
You're a stepping stone, Red Rooster.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a bit harsh. Anyway, so that was that. Gene Oakland's with Rick Rude and Bobby Heenan.
This is infamous. This one is infamous.
Why didn't you go ahead?
Well, the reason why is because, and I don't know if it showed on the original recording that Parv watched. I know it's not on the WWE Network one, but it's a pretty infamous botch where Gene is interviewing Rick Rude. They're in the queue. They're in the close-up, and they're panning outward. And what happens is Mean Gene is revving up, saying, "Gentlemen, I am here with." And what happens is in the back they have a SummerSlam logo. Well, right when he's going into his introduction with Rude and Bobby, the SummerSlam sign falls flat. And it makes a pretty loud bang noise on the back. And Gene gets jumpy when it drops. And he turns around and goes, "Fuck it." And it cuts away really quickly. I don't know if anybody has the original recording of it. It is not on the network version. I can confirm it. But it is one of the funniest on-air botches in the history of wrestling.
I don't remember seeing it earlier. I've definitely seen that, though. I've definitely seen that moment. It's very funny. I think that it was edited out of the one that I watched too, wherever it was from. So
it is quite hilarious. It's one of the first times that people really realize how edgy Gene could be when he recorded his stuff. Because if you watch his blooper reels, he could get a little salty with people, and this was one of those moments.
So the next match is the Rockers and Tito Santana taking on the Fabulous Rougeaus. And Rick Martel. Three little notes going into this. Number one, the fan in the crowd with the Ragu Sisters sign, I thought was quite funny. But are they Italian? Okay, I get it, but like, why? Why Ragu? So that was that. Secondly, I do not remember the model Rick Martel being managed by Slick. I really don't. I've seen this show many times. Was this the only time when, like, I don't remember Slick being Martel's manager. Do you, Aaron?
No, only here. I only remember it here. Glorious, but I only remember it here.
That must have been a very...
a jive soul bro in managing a French Canadian. Or a French, maybe. I think he's... Is he a French-Canadian or a French-American?
No, he's French-Canadian.
He is a French-Canadian.
And that was, in fact, my third note here, which I thought was very neat. Then Ventura pointed out that all three guys on that team can speak French. And I thought that was a really smart point.
I did miss the Rougeaus theme. That was a favorite. All-American boys. That was a good one.
Yes. Had such a great start to it.
Yeah, well, of course they played that on the version that I saw, so that was awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, well, Aaron, what do you make of this six-man?
I really liked it. This is one of the matches I remember when I was a kid and I'd watch it, I'd always skip over for whatever reason. I don't know why, but watching it again, it is one of my favorite matches on the card. I think it's solid, it's fun, and I'm a big Rougeaus fan, not just because I'm from Montreal, but just because I love their faux American characters. And everyone here had great chemistry, and I really liked it.
Andrew,
this is one of my favorites. Actually, I probably, even though the tag match with the Brainbusters and the Heart Foundation is a really good formula match, I think this one is more of a fun match, and it's one of the more memorable ones. You know, it was interesting watching Martel. Not as the model, but he's in his heel mode and he's trying to figure out what he's doing. So all he does is that one posture where he puts his hands out like Randy Orton, like, "Hey, look at me." Like, that was all he really had. He didn't have anything else. So watching him trying to develop his heel character was cool. Tito, every time Tito gets even remotely close to Rick Martel, the crowd goes fucking ballistic. And it climbs and climbs and builds until, you know, it gets to a point where the crowd just wants Tito to rip Martel's head off. The Rockers were terrific, and I thought the Rougeaus kind of carried their way into the match and did what they had to do. The Rockers were it was obvious how much the crowd loved the Rockers, so people think that the Rockers were such fan favorites that they were overrated as a team, and to that I say no. They were very, very good, and this is one of those examples.
Yeah, well, like you, Aaron, when I was a kid, I used to skip over this, or like I didn't, you know, I'd zone out during it or whatever. I have to be honest, it blew me away. I thought this was just terrific. I really did. Raymond Rougeaus, I think, is a really underrated worker. He hits a great savate kick at one point in this match, and Jacques has really good character work. And he's such an annoying little cock, you know, like the way he, like he just plays like a guy who you could imagine like bugging you, you know.
And dude, let me tell you, like, that is a true French Canadian. Like, I don't want to bury all French Canadians, but like the most annoying ones that I know and that are friends with or whatever, they are like that. There's a French word, if anybody speaks French, it's called bavard, and it just means like loudmouth dick.
Well, I mean, Jack, whatever that is, Jack was channeling that pretty well. But for me, the standout performance was by Rick Martel. He was like just terrific in this match, I thought. Like, I love the psychology because, like you said, basically Tito and Marcel play cat and mouse all the way through it. So, like, Martel's continuously giving Santana the slip all the way through. And they work that really great. And Martel's like such a great, like, you know, he only comes in when Tito's down.
Yeah.
And like, there's a moment where he comes into the match and like Tito's like on the floor. And Martel's such a prick, you know, he's like, he's telling him to get up, come on. And he's like, he's giving him the slip like all the way. So this is like really good, like backbreaker at one point. Just really like, and like you said, the moment when Tito finally gets his hands on him, the crowd are eating it up. So I gave it four. Meltzer went 3.25. I've given it 4. I think it was just a blow away great match.
And a harbinger of things to come. The hot tag to Shawn Michaels, where he just goes like full of fire and just starts going to town on I think it was Martel first that he got to. And oh man, so good. Because you could see, like, maybe you weren't sure at that time because Marty and Sean had just started which one was going to break. But there was, now that you know and you watch it retroactively and you do realize the little hints, like, yeah, Sean was the guy. He was the star.
Yeah.
That hot tag was really well worked. Like, they built up to it great. The crowd was eating out the hands. Really well worked match. I just want to have one little note on Rick Martel, because I think one of the things that, like, WF, like, guys who just grew up with WF and didn't really watch, like, haven't really gone back and watched a lot of territory stuff, or, like, only know Martel from the model kind of stuff. Like, Martel, by that point, had been a career babyface for, what, like, 15 mm-hmm. years or something?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is basically like turning. It's like turning Ricky Steamboat, is what it is.
He was a big-time champion in the AWA. He was the man after Kurt Hennig left.
Like, yeah, and Martel was, like, true blue, like pure baby face. And I mean, it is like, and I would say he's comparable to Ricky Steamboat. Like, he was a really underrated wrestler, you know. He's got plenty of great matches in his back catalog. So for him to turn around and give this sort of heel performance, I think is really pretty impressive, you know.
Yeah,
that was my thought.
Well, and is it crazy? It is that's absolutely true. And is it crazy to you guys that, like, they never blew off that feud on a pay-per-view?
No, because it was surprising to me that they never blew off Rick. Well, they didn't really blow off Rick Rude and Roddy Piper really on a pay-per-view, except unless you say the Survivor Series. But they didn't really blow it off. You know?
And it's funny, those all four of those guys you just mentioned go to WrestleMania 6 and kind of do nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, and they could have easily been all paid. Like, you could have had the Rick Rude, Roddy Piper blow off, and you could have had the Martel Santana blow off.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny because literally that's all Tito does for the next 2 years now, is like his big pay-per-view moment of the year is the moment where he enters the Royal Rumble and goes after Martel. And it's like he's still doing it in 1991, you know? It's like the only meaningful feud that Tito gets for like, I mean, because they never blow it off. He's always still after Martel, so.
I like to imagine they fight at the Hall of Fame ceremony every year backstage.
Okay, well, we get a recap of the whole Rude Warrior feud now, which was still ongoing at this point. And then Warrior gives us a promo. Any thoughts on this Warrior promo?
No, there are no thoughts in the promo.
No, there are no thoughts in the promo, yeah. I actually thought that Warrior's a little bit smaller at this point than he would be, I thought. Maybe it was just me.
You mean, like, muscular-wise?
Yeah, just he seemed a little bit skinnier than he would be in 1990.
Yeah, yeah, he didn't have the poofy hair and the extra biceps just yet.
Yeah, I mean, he's still obviously stacked, but, you know, not as, like, ridiculous as he would become. And so, yeah, here we go. Another match that people talk about quite a lot. Rick Rude versus the Ultimate Warrior for the IC title. Rude, obviously, the champion. Andrew, what do you reckon?
You know, you always hear in the same storyline every time someone wins the Intercontinental title, I want to restore the greatness of the Intercontinental Championship. I want to make it matter again and all this stuff. And it never does because it's already diluted itself to the point of nothingness, to be honest with you. But when you think of those, when you harken back to those times and you think of those great Intercontinental title matches and matchups, you think of Bret Hart and Mr. Perfect in 91. You think of all the way to the beginning. You go to Savage and Steamboat at WrestleMania 3, The Rock and Triple H in that ladder match, and Shawn and Razor in the ladder match. This is one of those matches. This is one of those matches where when you think of the Intercontinental Championship and what made it great and what signified great title holders, this is one of those top-tier Intercontinental title matches. Great story, perfectly told, high energy, not boring at all. Crowd loves it. And Rude, I think this was probably Rude's shining moment in the WWF. Even in a loss, I thought this was probably his best performance.
Aaron?
Yeah. Everything you just said about the Intercontinental title is bang on. I think Ultimate Warrior gets enough credit for being a great Intercontinental champion because he elevated that belt almost to main event status throughout his run. My buddy and I, we always talk about how there's a difference between a five-star match and a five-star experience, and that, like, a match doesn't necessarily have to be a technical masterpiece to be a five-star experience. What I mean by that is, like, in Andre the Giant and Hulk Hogan doesn't need to do moonsaults to make it a five-star experience. Like, the whole feel in the package for me is five stars. And that's kind of how I feel about this match, too. The build was great. The match, I think the match, even on its own, is very, very good. I think Warrior is a pretty underrated worker when it comes right down to it. And I just think the whole package from the storyline before, from the match itself, from even Piper getting involved, the emotion of the match, the promos, and the crowd reaction, it's a pretty perfect match for me. And it gives Warrior a pretty flawless record at SummerSlam so far, because in 88 he was awesome too with Honky. And again, that'd be another example of, like, what I'd call a five-star experience. Like, it's a 30-second match, but it's booked perfectly. And that's kind of how I felt about this one, too.
Well, Meltzer gives it 3.25. And he says that the booking was great, the Rude was great, but he thinks that Warrior was terrible in this match.
Go ahead, Aaron. How is that? How can a match be great and one half of it be terrible? I've never believed that. Whenever people bury the Warrior, they say, "Oh, Rude carried him to his matches," or like Hogan carried him to his great matches, or Savage carried him to his matches. But like, I think the Warrior has Rude's best WWF match. The Warrior has Hogan's best WWF match, probably. And Warrior has one of Savage's top WWF matches. So, like, at what point do we stop talking about this guy always being carried? And at what point do we, like, give him some credit for knowing what he's doing? And he has a good understanding, too, of doing the right thing at the right time.
Well, I mean, I'll just give you the exact the exact stuff that Meltzer points out. He says, Rude took one great bump after the other for the first 6 minutes of this match, including being pressed down to the floor, mainly because Warrior kept on trying to catch his breath, but he never did catch it because he must have been moving too fast. Warrior got crotched on the top rope, and then it was his turn to sell. That part of the match was pretty bad when Warrior was selling, according to Meltzer. So basically anything involving Warrior selling or Warrior, anything that isn't Rude pinballing, according to Meltzer, isn't good in this match.
No, there's a great, like Aaron was saying, there's a great story to the match also that doesn't involve the actual work ethic, in that what it is that in the start of the match, Warrior does his onslaught. And, you know, that was his typical, you know, signature deal where he would start off the match and he would be blazing out the gate and he would just be clotheslining and suplexing and doing everything and that he possibly could to run him over. And then finally, about 7 minutes into the match or 6 minutes into the match, Rude gets some offense and slows him down. And then they have a little bit of a powder on a headlock, I think, and Warrior starts coming back. And I thought Warrior never looked winded to me. After the rest hold, I thought he was just right with it. There's only one really awkward moment near the end where Rude wants to do a pile driver, but I think Warrior thought it was going to be like either a power bomb or something else, and it ends up being this like weird thing where where Rude like lands on his knee and power bombs him, but it looked like a pile driver. I was getting weird flashbacks of Owen and Austin.
I've called it a reverse tombstone in my notes.
Yeah. Yeah, it was very strange, but that was the one part where there was some miscommunication. I thought overall, though, they had really good chemistry. And the idea of a carry job, well, I always hated that because it's like, well, yeah, you can carry a guy to get – you can. It's like that old adage, you can bring a horse to water, but you can't make him drink it. You know, and I feel like when Warrior – would he be carried in certain portions of matches to certain segments? Yeah, sure, maybe, so that you can give him some rest after he's doing his spastic Warrior stuff. But once you get to the next segment, I mean, and he gets a second wind, I thought Warrior was just as entertaining and just as terrific as all the other performers that he was in the ring with.
Yeah.
I think it's a better match than Meltzer gives it credit for. I went 4 stars as well. And I said it's got a lot of high-end offense, more than basically any other match on this card. There's a lot of
Big move match.
It's a bomb. Yeah, lots of bombs. And there's actually one sequence where Warrior, you know, he throws a suplex. He does like a power bomb. He does a scoop power slam at one point, which is impressive for him.
Yeah, I think that was an improvisation for some reason, where they were out of position and Warrior just said, "Okay, I'm just gonna power slam you."
And I thought the heat sequences for Rude were pretty good. There was a really good false finish, finishing stretch before Piper came in.
The foot on the rope.
Yeah, I thought that was a really good moment, and like Bobby was selling it really well. My only criticism would be that at times, Warrior seemed a little bit ponderous, or maybe he was like looking around a little bit to get his his timing was maybe a split second off or whatever, but nothing that took away from the match too much. So
the other thing too is that anybody who wants to question how popular the Ultimate Warrior really was going into WrestleMania 6, this is a perfect example of how big he really was. The crowd, I would almost say he got a bigger pop than Hulk Hogan did when he comes out. It was really that big of a pop, or that big of an entrance for him. And when the pinfall comes and he wins, the crowd goes bananas.
Yeah. Yeah, he, I'm glad he's no longer like the forgotten guy in history, because he was a huge star and he does deserve to be recognized as such.
Okay, well, I think this one stands up pretty well. If I had to push you guys on, if I had to push you, I went 4 stars. Do you think that's about right?
Yeah, it's exactly right.
Yeah.
And just out of interest, that 6-man tie, I went 4 stars on that as well. Well, where would you guys go on it?
I'd say 3.5. Okay. Yeah. It wasn't enough.
I'd say if you're looking at it wrestling wise, it's probably I'd put that 4 and then Warrior Rude 4, but as an overall experience for me, it's Warrior Rude.
Okay. So I think this is where we get now the conveyor belt of promos.
Yes, the long winding road. Yeah.
We get Mr. Perfect. This is where he buries the Red Rooster. You're just a stepping stone. Piper comes in now, and was it just me, or was Piper basically just coked out of his mind here?
We had a glass in his hand. Was that glass filled with booze before?
Yeah, and was he eating an apple? I can't remember. He was doing so many weird things in that freaking promo.
But he'd clearly just been snorting coke with his sniffs, you know? He's just like, I don't know. Like, this is where he called Heenan the eunuch, and just bizarre.
Well, it's funny because they do the conveyor belt segment, like you're saying, and Roddy does the interview, and then about two guys later, Rude does the interview, and you're thinking to yourself, well, Rude and Piper can't be that far away. I can just imagine Piper laughing his ass off about 5 feet to the right of the camera while Rude is pointing at the camera saying he's going to kill Piper for costing him the belt. That's the one thing I was laughing at when I was watching it.
Garvin gets about 10 seconds because
Roddy Garvin, what are you doing in that suit?
Gene Okerlund is so happy to see him. I don't know if I've ever seen him happier.
There's a lot of boys that are happy to see Ronnie Garvin.
One thing that Heenan does very well is the pissed off, livid kind of, you know, heel injustice promo. And he gives a great one here. He's so fired up. He's pissed off. He wants a rematch right now. Rude is pretty annoyed as well. And I loved it because they went back to the Tony, and Ventura's also really pissed off.
You remember when Flair lost the belt at WrestleMania 8 and Bobby is just going to town and the camera, Ric Flair is staring with that blood on his face? That reminded me of that one when Rude is just staring at the camera with this like disgusted look on his face and Bobby is just screaming and making every excuse in the book for why he lost. The other funny part was when Rude got away with a curse word by doing a little tongue-in-cheek there where they're doing the instant replay and he's crying saying that I was about to win the match and Piper showed me his, and he pauses and he goes, ask Bobby. that was the funny part.
I noticed that.
Yeah, the look on his face was like almost catatonic. He was breathing so heavily. It's like he was getting like a really like subpar blowjob and just like enjoying it, but not still angry that it was happening.
I wonder how many subpar blowjobs Rick Rude actually did get in 1989. I'm sure he got plenty.
Well, he's pretty tall, so.
So anyway, no, that was really good, and that post match at WrestleMania 8, I think, is one of the best moments in history. I love that. Another 6-man tag now. First of all, we get a bit of a recap of the Hogan Zeus feud, but we're more on that later. We have basically the Demolition and Jim Duggan, all wearing masks. Duggan's got a mask on, which Ventura is very keen to point out looks like Jason from Friday the 13th. So
not even close.
50 Shades of USA is what I call it.
They are taking on Team Beef, which consists of Andre, Akeem, and Big Boss Man. Has there ever been a fatter team?
Well, I love the fact that they had to mention the combined weight. The combined weight of 1,338 pounds. That was the funniest part. That's the one part about wrestling I do miss. They don't say the weights anymore.
Yeah.
Don't they say the weights?
What's that?
They don't say the weights.
The weight sizes and when they do introductions for the WWE now?
Yeah.
Not as often as they used to. Sometimes they'll do it like for the championship match intro, which they'll do in the ring. They'll do that sometimes, but overall, no. They usually don't do it.
Heenan, obviously having just blown a gasket in the back, doesn't come out straight away. He comes out a little bit later. My one note going into this is that I absolutely love the fact that Jesse Ventura wanted the American Constitution to be changed to prevent Jim Duggan from ever having the U.S. flag painted on his face again. I love Jesse's hate for Duggan, you know?
Yeah.
Hey, Scott Criscolo does too.
Yes.
You mentioned Heenan. I love that he's not wearing his jacket anymore because he was ranting and raving in the pack. And he's clearly frustrated right from the moment he gets back into this match, too.
Always in character, Bobby Heenan.
Yeah.
What do you make of this one, Andrew?
Oh, it was okay. You know, I missed the Demolition theme. Listening to it was a breath of fresh air because it's one of the better ones that the WWE did at the time, WWF did at the time. And Andre was actually pretty involved in the match. I was kind of surprised at how much effort he actually put into it, because usually with Andre, you're just kind of just stunned by his presence. You know, for him to actually be involved in a match surprises you. And I thought he did okay here. I thought Demolition was pretty cool. And Hacksaw, he gets a little 2x4. What I really loved is the way how he caught the 2x4 so that he could hit one of Heenan's guys with it. The way he, cause it like pops up in the air like a toy. And then he grabs it and hits him with it. I thought that was a little funny, but it was just a decent comedy. It was kind of a comedy match of sorts. It was okay.
All right.
I thought it was fun. I really like Demolition, and you're right. They were very fat. There's a lot of fat in that match. Whenever I see those fat guys now, like back then I was scared of them. Now I just like, I try to picture them as children and how much sadness they probably had within their hearts. So there's probably a lot of sadness in that ring. And like, I don't know, that's great, I guess. So anyway, let's just, if we're going to talk about them being fat, let's just acknowledge how sad they are at the same time.
Well, I was very sad that Team Beef lost. I wanted them to win. Like, it seems a bit strange to have Demolition and Duggan go over them. And obviously Akeem would be the one who'd be pinned, right? But, yeah.
Well, are there three more protected guys in the company at that point, like aside from Hogan and Warrior, than Duggan and Demolition? Like, did Duggan ever lose a match in the whole history?
Duggan was insanely protected
all
the time. I mean, even when he did lose, it'd be by DQ most of the time. And he'd always get to retain his heat by hitting the... Now, I have to say, I didn't hate anybody more when I was a kid than Jim Duggan. I was right there with Jesse. Like, you know, I fucking hated Duggan. I couldn't understand why anybody cheered for him. And I still can't.
It's because you're not American. Like, he would come up to Montreal for house shows and he'd try to get the crowd to chant USA. Like you're fighting Dino Bravo. You're not winning this argument here.
Yeah, but he made up for it by joining Team Canada in the later years.
One thing about this match too, Slick's pre-match dance routine is spectacular. It's good like 30 seconds.
No one could cut the rug like the Dr. Style Slick.
Yeah. When I went back and watched some 80s recently, there was so much more dancing. There's Slick, there's Honky Tonk Man doing like 3-minute dances before matches. Like,
I miss managers. I miss talented managers.
And yeah. Of course, the best answer of all, Akeem.
Oh.
there's a fantastic moment on commentary near the end when Jesse's complaining about the use of the 2x4, and Shivani reminds him of something he said earlier on, and he's like, "You've got no right to quote me at all, little man." I love that. Just completely shut him down. We go to a promo by Ted DiBiase, who mentions Jake, and he calls him just another sorry statistic, which I thought was an interesting was that a possible nod to his upcoming sentence, sorry statistic? I doubt it, but you know, could take it that way.
Well, it's certainly apropos when you look at his life as a whole.
And now the Fink announces that Ron Garvin is our surprise ring announcer. So before we get into the match, Ron Garvin, the ring announcer, Aaron.
Worst thing in the history of civilization, maybe. Like, not funny, not good, not comprehensible. He doesn't know whether he's coming or going. Like, what does that mean? Like, why should Greg Valentine be upset with that? It makes no sense.
He's like the drunk uncle at your family party doing knock-knock jokes at 11 o'clock at night.
Yeah. And he's sweating so much in that tuxedo. Like, it's like he's never worn a tuxedo in his life, it feels like, watching him. Yeah.
And it's like he can't wait to tell this joke about Greg Valentine. And it's like, I mean, the crowds, at least they participate a little bit by laughing. He only gets one good line in there about Valentine, is that he has two left feet. But the rest of it is just stupid. And it doesn't make sense.
The only wrestler with two left feet. I mean, it's hardly the king of zingers there, is it?
Yeah. He's coming into the depression, for God's sake, for that joke.
He calls him he calls Greg his so-called opponent. He's so mild. To me, he looks like he's overweight by 30 pounds. I thought that was probably the... probably.
But if you ask me, like, but he has to preface it by with, if you ask me, he's just. Sorry, go on.
Greg did look kind of bloated on this show, though.
I'll tell you what, Vince loved taking the NWA champions and putting them down a peg. Because he did it with Dusty, he did it with he even did it in a little way with Arn and Tully by turning them into, you know, into basically, you know, mid-level guys. And then with, look at Ronnie Garvin, he was the NWA title. He had the NWA title 2 years before that, and now look at him. He's having a feud with Greg Valentine. So Greg Valentine too was an NWA guy, and you know.
Meanwhile, I mean, this is pretty late, and Greg had been the IC champ, and you talked about matches that elevated the IC title. He has a feud with Tito Santana in '85 that I recommend. But I thought Greg, you know, like when pregnant women kind of go a bit red in the face. I thought Greg had that kind of look about him tonight.
You think Greg was knocked up at the time of SummerSlam 89?
Yeah, he could have been, judging by his face.
Nice.
Anyway, he's taking on Hercules at this point, who has some interesting music. I just wanted to say that he may be the least over guy on this entire card. Because the crowd just does not give a shit about Hercules.
Yeah, but it's because you're in like a Christian country. If you were in Greece, like, he'd be revered.
Well, the thing about Hercules that always bugged me was the idea that, because when you think of Hercules, you think of like, wow, this chiseled, super strong guy. And when you would look at Hercules compared to a lot of other guys on the roster, you would look at him like, he's not really that big. You know, he's not that big. He's not that strong. He's not that bulky. I mean, I remember times where Randy Savage probably had him beat in the bicep department compared to Hercules Hernandez. So, yeah, that was the one thing about him.
Do you guys think it undermined him at all that his father was in the main event?
His father?
Zeus.
Sorry, I took a moment to twig there.
Sorry, but I guess we're not big on the Greek mythology place to be.
I guess Zeus had a white wife. I don't know.
I do know they say that. I mean, I do know that Zeus is meant to have had a particularly epic, you know, genitals.
Nice.
Speaking of genitals,
Greg picks up a cheap win with his foot on the ropes, Garvin announces Hercules as the winner.
Matters.
He announces Hercules as the winner twice, which was the funnier part. He says, "The winner is Hercules," and then he said, "No." He said, "No, no." He says, "Oh no, wait, I'm sorry. The winner by disqualification is Hercules." That was the only fun part of the whole match. That's the only thing I even remember. And then Valentine gives him that nice little cheap shot.
Yeah, that's the best part of the match. Mid sentence, right out of nowhere. Beautiful.
I mean, it's a stiff one too. It's a nice little shot right to the face.
What I think is interesting about this is that, as lame as the Garvin stuff was, the crowd were into it. And the crowd were into, like, the crowd cheered when Garvin announced Hercules as the winner. But the cheer was for Garvin. So it was really weird. Like, Hercules just, when it was actually Hercules himself, they didn't pop for his near falls. They didn't pop for him, like, putting his arm up. Like, I've never seen a guy less over than Hercules during the match. And then it's almost like to add insult to injury, they're going to cheer for Ronnie Garvin as well. There's another promo now involving Sherry. And a cauldron.
Yeah.
Black cauldron.
any thoughts on this?
Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
Anything that goes into that, like, that fantastical mode with the WWF in the late 80s, I love. Like, when Ricky Steamboat was at the dojo learning karate and Fuji Vice and all that stuff where it gets a little fantastical, I love it. And Macho and Sherry, I mean, who better to go larger than life with something like that than those two? Because they're otherworldly as it is when it comes to, you know, space and time, so... You know, they're doing their thing, and I love it because Macho, you know, he does the thing with the fingers. So he's got his fingers over like the pot of whatever the hell it should be, black magic or whatever the fuck it is. And Macho's got the fingers, and he's like twirling it, like he's like sprinkling something into the cauldron, like, ooh yeah, Zeus is gonna. I love it. I, that was a really fun segment.
Sherry's kind of work, she like was around this, because on the build up they kept on calling her Scary Sherry rather than Sensational. Like, she's kind of working a slightly different gimmick around this time, like more towards like being maybe a witch or something.
The only thing I take offense is that Shivani and the good guy, the, you know, the face announcers were making this premise that Sherry was ugly. And I, even with the wicked makeup, I never thought Sherry was an ugly woman. That's the only part about it that I always found a little bit stupid. But that was really the only thing about Sherry that bugged me.
Well, I mean, in the words of Al Pacino, she had a great ass, right?
Well, she was a tough bitch. You didn't want to fuck with her.
Yeah. Okay. So the next match then, Ted DiBiase. Who, I'll remind you, headlined the last SummerSlam, is now taking on Jimmy Snuka. So he was in No Man's Land here in 1989, basically, I think, because the guy he was feuding with, Jake, was out of action. So DiBiase kind of didn't have a lot to do. In fact, he has a very nothing 1989 in general for him. What did you make of this match, Aaron?
Well, for me, there's a rule. If it's a Ted DiBiase match on pay-per-view, I generally don't like it. I know he's your favorite guy, right? But I just find all of his pay-per-view matches just deathly slow. And I love the character, but I was always a little disappointed at the pay-per-view stuff. So this was no exception, and help that it had no heat or no story or anything. But yeah, didn't do it for me. Probably my least favorite match on the card.
Andrew?
Yeah, and the sad part about it is that with DiBiase, he was like a stronghold at Mid-South, and he really was great. And so to watch him in these WWF matches where he never really stood out or had one really great match was a little disappointing. The other thing that's interesting, and because I'm not sure about the timeline, is that I don't think Snuka had been back with the company for quite a while once he was at SummerSlam. I mean, I think he was only back, what, like maybe like late 88, maybe early 89?
Well, he came back at WrestleMania 5 and, like, didn't wrestle.
Yeah, so it was cool to see Snuka back, and he was obviously a little extra roided up, you know. And the match was really forgettable. I honestly don't remember anything about the match itself. But that was really it. And also the Million Dollar Belt. That's all I remember.
Yeah, major props to the Million Dollar Belt, because that was always awesome.
Yeah, I mean, this is the definition of a nothing match they've stuck on just before the main event. You know, now is the time to go and get your drinks. Now is the time to visit the concession stall, right? So that's basically what the match was doing. Just kind of strange, and Snuka was doing nothing either. So, you know, here, have a match on pay-per-view. And I guess that's it. I mean, do they still do that in the WWE these days? Just like have a nothing match on pay-per-view for no reason?
Yeah, it's called Monday Night Raw. Yeah. Oh, no. Oh, you said on pay-per-view? Yeah, it's even worse now, because now that they're on the network, they know that they don't have to draw people in to watch every match. So now they can experiment by having the middle of the pay-per-view be a bunch of ridiculous garbage segments and promotional materials. So actually, it's worse than it's ever been.
Yeah, like they'll announce like for a pay-per-view, they'll announce like four matches, and then the rest will just be surprises, but you're never pleasantly surprised.
So there's a promo by Hogan and Beefcake, during which Beefcake suggests that he may use his shears in some way, which I was thinking, you know, what, as a weapon? No, you're not, Beefcake. What a total lie. And there's kind of like, because there were quite a lot of promos by Hogan and Beefcake on that countdown that I watched. And there was like a weird dynamic where Beefcake was like worried about the challenge of Zeus, and Hogan was saying, "Trust me, don't worry, I've got this, brother." Savage like talks about Beefcake as being the weak link, and they're going to target him and stuff. I thought it was kind of quite interesting the way they worked that. Any thoughts on Beefcake as Hogan's friend to the end? I guess that's a more interesting question.
Oh man, I mean, Ed Leslie was not the worst wrestler ever, but he's close. And I mean, for Hogan to be buddies with certain people, there's a lot of wrestlers that are top tier guys, and they were friends with certain people that got pushes just because of them and didn't deserve it. That happens all the time. I mean, that's what. I don't want to pick on too many people, but, you know, I remember when Kurt Angle was friends with Luther Reigns, and Luther Reigns got a push, and it was like, you're pushing the wrong guy. I know he's your fucking friend, but don't push this guy. And Hogan had so much power in wrestling that he was able to push Brutus Beefcake, slash the Zodiac, slash the Butcher, slash the Booty Man, slash whatever the fuck he called himself after that, and push that guy through WWF and WCW for God knows how long. But Beefcake, at this point, in terms of, like, athletically, was probably in his prime. Even though in his prime, I'd still call him a D performer. But, you know, at least it's something, you know. At least you're getting the best out of somebody, you know.
Yeah, and like we mentioned earlier, too, with Dusty, like, at the very least, Brutus the Barber Beefcake was always over.
Oh, the fans loved the Barber.
That's it. So it's like, you know, like you could do worse than that. And his matches were fine, like never great, but never offensive really either. Like
they'd get close though.
Yeah. Is he the worst wrestler to ever be given that much of a push? Because, like, you know, Luther Reigns was pushed for like 2 months kind of thing, you know?
Oh yeah. In terms of the main event. Oh.
Like,
you know, I don't know. There's a few of them that I always hated JBL, and and I'm trying to think off the top of my head.
There's no way that JBL is worse than Beefcake. He's not even in the same league as Beefcake.
Yeah.
Fucking Starrcade '94 is it?
Oh my god.
And this is, and also by the way, this is before the parasailing accident. So, you know, Beefcake probably had was a little bit. He was still in his prime, like I was saying, as a wrestler, even though that doesn't say much. But at least he was a good counterpart to Hogan. He was like a friend to the end, and it shows in the match itself. So
I think the initial Renegade push in WCW, if you know who that is.
Yes,
yeah, I know Renegade.
That's a pretty monster push at the beginning. He'd probably be someone I'd say who's worse than Beefcake.
Yeah,
and let's face it, Zeus.
Now I wouldn't call him the weak link of the match. Zeus is the weak link of the match, obviously. Yeah. But Zeus had like his tag team partner is not only one of the greatest wrestlers in the history of wrestling. He's also one of the most complimentary wrestlers in the history of wrestling, where it's making somebody else with not as much talent look good. And I thought Savage did a great job of as a partner. Letting Zeus do just enough to not look weak, you know.
Well, just before we get to that match, no further thoughts on Ed Leslie, I guess. For me, the greatest moment of his career was getting smashed in the face by IRS's briefcase.
Harsh.
I liked him running away from Sid Justice when Sid Justice destroyed the barbershop and had that weird shaving cream all over his face.
Yeah, I mean, I pretty much hate the guy.
on a personal level, it sounds like.
Well, I mean, basically his entire WCW run is just an insult to not just to the company itself, but to wrestling. It's like that guy just.
Except for Kimberly in those tighties when she was the Booty Man's valet. That's the only good part.
Just think about what they do. They retire Ric Flair and they fucking replace him with Brutus Beefcake. And they headline Starrcade with it.
Hey man, Hogan happens.
Anyway, there's a poem now by the Genius, and I don't know if you guys know, but I am a lecturer in English literature, and I do have some literary criticism here because I've always thought the Genius's poems use a very odd rhyme scheme, and I wrote it down. It goes A B C B. But the line lengths are all very uneven. His meter is not very good. So for me, Genius's poems never seem like they flow. Like they don't like, and the rhymes are always so far apart that you've almost forgotten what it's rhyming with. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
I have never been a fan of the Genius's poems for this reason. They could be a lot better than they are.
He's no Dr. Lugnomics, that's for sure.
Oh, come on. Has John Cena ever actually rapped, or has he only ever read poetry into a microphone?
Hey, that is poetry of the street, my friend.
Have you guys seen PN News?
Yes. His Great American Bash 91 rap is – I literally listened to it. It is my ringtone.
Well, while we're on this subject of rap and wrestling and 1989.
And I'm glad we're on it.
Run DMC at WrestleMania 5. Now, I have never understood why they – I mean, what? They have, what, six, seven, 8 minutes of, you know, right in the middle of WrestleMania 5, right? And they don't rap. Neither, like, they don't cut any verses. They just go, yo, baby, WrestleMania. And then they don't rap. I've never understood why, like, why cut a verse or something.
The only thing I can think of is that they were being, it was more of a PC deal because it was considered, it's still, even though it was getting popular, rap was still considered in the late 80s in suburbia as dangerous. And I guess they didn't want, Vince didn't want to try to cut off the parents who wanted the kids to watch their shows by having people spit out lyrics, you know? That's the only thing I can even imagine.
You know what probably happened is that Vince probably got word of them through Walk This Way, so he probably thought they were a rock band because of the song with Aerosmith. And then he was like, what, they rap? Oh, no. And that's why they didn't rap, probably.
Who's going to get offended by Run DMC? What like a guy talking about his trainers, like my Adidas or...
That's why the only thing I can even imagine. I don't know. Maybe Run DMC. Maybe they just didn't have anything and they just cut the check and left and they didn't think about even rapping when they did it.
So I mean, what?
Yeah. Anyway, any other thoughts on rap in wrestling, or should we get to this main event? Zeus and Randy Savage are taking on Brutus Beefcake and Hulk Hogan, and Hogan has a little note for the Fink, and of course the Fink introduces their manager for the match, Miss Elizabeth, and Jesse goes off on one here, calling her a gold digger, and I actually think he makes some really good points. So,
that's the infamous part about Jesse. That's where this whole thing becomes a really like a pop culture quandary a little bit, where Jesse was right all along about Hogan being a backstabber and a cheater and a scumbag and all this stuff that he always said about Hogan, but we were so deep into the forest that we never saw the trees with Hogan, and now that we go back and we look at it, you know, after the fact, we realize, man, Hogan really was a punk to Savage, and Savage was more than justified with treating Hogan like trash and dumping Elizabeth because Elizabeth wants to run to Hogan, and it's just so funny. It's almost like Jesse was like the voice of realism, and everybody is in fucking Idiocracy, you know.
But I don't like at one point, like because he's saying, you know, she's just gonna side with a winner. She's a fair weather.
Oh, he calls her a tramp.
Fair-weathered tramp?
No, he says a fair-weathered sailor, I think. That's what he said. That's what they call it. We call him a fair-weathered sailor or something. And then in the middle of the match, he calls him a tramp. And Tony's got no comeback. Tony says, well, she stands by her man.
Absolutely not. Absolutely
stand by her man. Jesse's completely right. Fuck you, Elizabeth. Sorry, you know. Aaron, any thoughts on Elizabeth's moral compass here?
It's shit. Her moral compass is shit, obviously. And Jesse is right. No one wants to hear the truth. Like, watching back now, like, watching that whole angle, you're like, how is Savage the bad guy? What did he do wrong? Even Savage's turn. It's like... Like, Elizabeth isn't dying, but he leaves him to be beaten up by the two biggest, fattest men, saddest men in the whole promotion.
Yeah. Well, it's just a great execution and suspension of disbelief and making everybody buy into one thing, even though from a society type standpoint, it doesn't make any sense. But that's just good execution from a storyline standpoint, with all the way back to when the Mega Powers exploded at WrestleMania 5, you know. But
I think somebody should make a thing I don't know if you'd make it into a book, or you can maybe make it into a compilation, but you know, the murky moral compass of Hulk Hogan, showing all the fucking dick things he did all the way through his, because he was a dick, like he was never not a dick.
Yeah.
throughout this entire run.
Yeah, and I love it when he turned heel in WCW, Bobby Heenan would be like, yeah, I told you, I've been telling you for years. Like, he carried on the Jesse torch.
So, I mean, I thought this was worked pretty smartly, this match. Zeus was indestructible. Hogan, I thought, was a pretty good face in peril.
And Zeus loves bear hugs.
He loves a bear hug. I mean, I went 3 stars. I thought it was pretty good. What do you guys think?
Yeah, that's about right.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, like you said earlier, they put him in there with the absolute right guy in Savage. And it just clicked, and it was fine, and it worked, and you accepted it for what it was, and it was just like a fun main event.
Yeah, but, and Savage is a rehearsal nut. He's a method wrestler. Everybody knows that. So he's obviously rehearsed just enough stuff with the guy who played Zeus so that they did a little bit of team-up stuff, and you could tell that Zeus's number was done, and he could go to the ringside, because what Savage would do is that he would get really close to Zeus, and he would, like, rub his head. And that was him saying, like, you did a good job, brother. Get back to ringside. I'll take care of the rest. And Savage is still in his prime at this point. I mean, I keep saying in his prime. A lot of these guys in the late 80s were right on the cusp of being great. And some of them got pushes and some didn't. And Randy was one of the guys who did get the push. And he was such a star. And that was the one guy I appreciated even more watching the match. And that was Savage. He's just on fire in this match.
Yeah, I mean, Savage is really the super worker in WF at this time, and he was, like, tremendous. And, you know, he basically, like, carried, you know, a lot of the match. But I do think that Hogan's performance is easily overlooked, because he really worked face and peril for the majority of the match, and that is really Hogan's key strength as a worker, is selling and,
yeah,
and generating sympathy, and he does it really well, and he gets Zeus over. You know, I actually think that they really worked to every guy's strength in this match. I mean, Beefcake was kind of kept to a minimum, which is good. Like, Zeus only really came in where it made sense for him to come in. And then Hulk Hogan gives a Sensational Sherry an atomic drop. And Jesse just goes insane. This is a disgrace. He's hitting a woman. An atomic drop on Sherry. And then, like, bizarrely, she kind of no-sells it. Like, she kind of no-sells the atomic drop. I mean,
well, because she's looking out for Elizabeth, who's about to sack her with the purse. Looking for a spot.
She's looking for a spot, but it comes across like she knows, because this is clearly not like Rick Rude selling of the atomic drop. But,
No, it is not.
I just wanted to like pause briefly, because I've always wondered, where does the atomic drop attack? Like, where does it hurt?
I want to say the coccyx bone. Like, it's the only thing that makes sense to me, because otherwise it's just directly to the rectum, and I don't even want to think about that.
I was just wondering, like, do women not have one of them?
A coccyx? I know you're an English lit, but come on.
But it didn't seem to affect Sherry in the way that it affects most guys. Just like...
Well, she's got a nice ass, so maybe maybe it was a little more cushiony, and it just, cause she kind of bounced like that, you know.
Cushioned it, and then Elizabeth, to complete her complete heel turn here, whacked Sherry out.
And did we ever find out what was in the purse?
No, probably a brick.
That
probably
was a loaded. Brick. That was such a loaded purse.
So I mean, how can the fans cheer this guy? He just hit a woman now.
The one funny part was with Jesse when he was like in the beginning, when Sherry uses the purse, he goes, oh, she's just using her purse. I mean, every woman carries a purse. And then when Hogan uses, that's a foreign object. I mean, Jesse with the double standard on Hogan. I mean, it works against him, but most of the ways it works for him.
So I think, like, you think 3 stars about right. Meltzer went 2.5.
Just Savage alone, yes.
He gave this match the same star rating as the opener?
Yes.
Ah.
No.
I see.
But then so did I. I also gave it 3 stars.
Yeah, that's right.
And also a story of the whole show. The crowd at the Meadowlands was red hot the whole show. They really never – they really only had one lull, and that was DiBiase and Snuka. But most of the match, they were basically on fire. And even in this main event, they kept that energy up to where he slams Zeus and gives him the leg drop. And then when he stands up and looks at Sherry after he pins Zeus, the crowd is just always there the whole show. They never really let up. That's probably one of the hottest crowds I've ever seen for a show.
I should mention the Meltzer actually gave the opener only 2 stars, so he gave the main event 0.5 star more.
That's just fun.
So let's just give out a couple of awards at the end of the show then. I want to give MVP, Match of the Night, and Worst Performer, Least Valuable Player. So let's go with the MVP picks first. Andrew, I'll go with you first.
Rick Rude.
Rude for you? Aaron?
I'll go Randy Savage.
I'm going to go with Rick Martel. I thought he was terrific in that match. So, but all three of them, I think, are worthy contenders for that.
I think we're leaving out someone pretty big, though, too, that we should probably just mention as a honorable mention is Jesse.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Jesse is basically an MVP contender in every single card he ever announced to me. Because he's just always – he's never not good in my mind. Match of the night. Aaron?
Warrior Root.
Andrew?
Two really good match. Well, you know what? I lie. One really good match with the six-man tag, two great ones with the Hearts and the Brainbusters and Warrior Rude. But in a pinch, I'd go with Warrior and Rude. That's the more memorable match.
I'm going to go with the six-man. I thought it was traumatic. I really thought that was great.
It's fair, man. It's a really great match.
I mean, let's be honest. This is more of a theory for me overall for the show. The Great American Bash 89 was about a month earlier, and that was one of the best shows that the NWA WCW ever put on. And I felt like they had a little bit of pressure on them that they had to deliver something really good. And it's very, very rare, even in the best times of the WWF, that we saw three really good 15-minute-plus matches in one show. And this is one of those examples that we got them.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't disagree with that. This is definitely better than the average kind of pay-per-view card around this time. Least valuable player, Aaron.
Rugged Ronnie Garvin. Even though he, to the delight of Gene Okerlund, I still can't do it. I still can't vote for him anything else.
Andrew.
That one's. probably Terry Taylor.
Terry Taylor. Let me have a think about who my least valuable player is. Hold on. Hogan's morality. what else? I have to think. Piper, probably, actually. That promo was horrible. I think Piper. I really didn't like his promo.
Well, the only thing about Piper that I'll give him a little bit of credit, he wasn't so much of a distraction to the Warrior Rude match that it ruined it. That's the only thing I can say.
Yeah, it's funny because like in the show you have like the highest of highs, but the lows are pretty shitty too.
That's the WWF in general. You got the cringeworthy stuff like Uncle Elmer getting married and all that stupid crap, and then you got the really great stuff like Hogan and Andre and Hogan.
Hold on. Uncle Elmer's wedding is one of the greatest moments in wrestling history purely because of Jesse.
Am I on the right podcast?
Jesse. Jesse shits all over that wedding, and it's amazing. So if I was going to make a highlight reel of Jesse's career, that would be the centerpiece. What an amazing performance by him. So, it's worth it just for that, for me. All right, guys. So I think we're all giving SummerSlam 89 a thumbs up.
Yeah, absolutely.
Two thumbs up. Yeah, for sure.
Do you think out of all of the ones that people are covering, and I can't remember which ones, 97, 2005, a couple of, do you think we picked the best one?
Yes.
Yeah, 05 is a good show, though. And I don't remember some of the ones in the later years that are going to get recapped. But among them all, and I'm trying to remember them all, there's 05, there's 97. I think this is the best one. Unless someone picked 92. 92 is better.
See, I don't think 92. I think there's only really two SummerSlams that are better than it, I think. And I think it might, for me, it's maybe like 2002 and I think 2013. For me, anyway.
Yeah. The last year's SummerSlam was excellent. You're right about that. 2002 is my favorite. You hit that one right. But SummerSlam 89, that's one of the best ones. And when it comes to late 80s WWF, even if you count all the Saturday night's main events and the special MTV's shows, I would say SummerSlam 89 might be like the second best show, maybe the third best show from the WWF that entire decade.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I don't know. The thing is that there is an awful lot of MSG and Spectrum cards, so it's hard to say. But in terms of the big pay-per-views, I'm inclined to agree that's definitely one of the best. Of this early kind of period for pay-per-views, it's definitely one of the better shows.
And it's interesting because you got that new infusion of guys that they poached out of the NWA and the AWA and territories, guys like Kurt Hennig coming on up and Rick Martel finally gets his push and... You know, Arn and Tully are in there. Dusty Rhodes has just got to the company. And you got a lot of fresh faces, and they're still capable of doing things. And I think you get a little mix of everything in that show. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah. All right. Well, it's been thanks a lot, guys. It's been fun talking to you. And, well, okay. I guess join us, join another group of people on the next Rewind show. Right?
Yeah, or all the other ones that are probably already up, because I think we were last.